which they will ask. There are hadith that tell us we will be asked about our youth, our wealth, our health, our time, and our life in general. What are we going to answer? I spend my life doing a 9-to-5 job and, you know, taking my family on vacation once a year and, I don't know, grocery shopping and watching news and scrolling through Instagram and TikTok and YouTube. Maybe a few lectures once a year during Muharram and Safar. Really? Is that the kind of image I want to flash before my eyes during my final hours? There's more that we can do. Simply by making the active intention of investing our time and energy into more than this. One act of continuous kindness a month, but do it through your entire life with the intention of gaining Allah's satisfaction and making the world a better place in order to create the groundwork for Imam Zaman's reappearance. You'd be serving Dhuhr, and that would be your value. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, issues, and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is a dear friend and guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, dear listeners, we'll be talking about how we may identify obstacles we may face when raising our children and how to correctly get over them. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadan wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajum. Now, previously, we were talking about how we can become better educators and parents in terms of raising our children. Today, we want to start to look at things or obstacles that might be in our way and prevent us from becoming those excellent, outstanding parents and educators. So there are many things that we ourselves create, obviously, with the wrong, us having the wrong idea and the wrong ideology about them. And we think they are good, but in fact they are bad.
Right.
All right. So I begin with what I would like to call and some sort of like a fake kind of honor. Now, what do I mean by that? As parents, sometimes we define honor and dignity and as me being harsh, me being strong and being tough.
Unquestionable authority.
Yeah, unquestionable authority. Therefore, I'm keeping my honor and my dignity, right?
Right.
So you've seen such parents where the kids, when they deal with them, they deal with them as like a general and a soldier.
Right.
You can, like, from the way they deal with the parents, you can tell there's something not right here, right?
It's boot camp.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I've seen this many times when I see, when I go to people and stuff like that, I see this kind of relationship, which is kind of, you know, straight away I can tell there's something wrong. When I see the son comes and he's like, he's walking, and the way he gives me the tea or the water, and then he
very carefully
goes back, and then I'm like, okay, there's something wrong here. Something wrong in the picture, right? So that's because the parent themselves, they think that in order for me to maintain my power and authority in the house, I have to act like this. If I smile, if I joke around with my kids, if I let my guard down, if I play with them, if I let them go on my back, and I don't know, we have fun, this way I lose my honor. I lose my respect in the house.
What a weird concept.
Yeah. Right. So no. It's actually not a weird concept. It's a very common concept,
right,
especially, sad to say this, but especially in the Arabic kind of mentality. The Arabs back in the day, they used to have it, and you can still see the same trend continuing.
They're very macho,
in
as
the Arabic,
call it.
Yeah, in the Arabic world today. They have this mentality that I have to maintain being strong and firm in order to become dignified and honored in the house. Otherwise, I would lose my respect.
Right. And with that, dear Sayyid, we'll be going on a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to properly identify obstacles we may face when raising our children and how to solve them. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
And we said that with this kind of mindset, with this kind of mentality, it's not right, right?
Right.
And, I mean, if anyone wanted, should have been hard and firm and, you know, trying to maintain his honor and
his prestige, whatever it is,
right?
Right.
And to maintain that strong personality kind of
his
figure.
His masculinity.
Okay, yeah. If anyone would have done that, it would have been the prophets.
Of course.
Because they are the example for
the perfect human beings.
Now, when we look at the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, our beloved Prophet, you can see that with him and children, like, and this is like something I always
admire about the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, and this is actually something that I have applied so much into my life, is how he bring himself to a child's level. Now, the Sahaba, the companions of the Prophet, they can see this man, like Rasulullah, Rahmatul Lil Alameen.
Right.
Look at the titles that Allah has given him.
Person closest to
Allah.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, he's like, without him, this whole existence would not exist.
Right.
What else more
the
than
beloved
that?
Of Allah.
And yeah, and then you see him, like, down on his knees, or, you know, playing with kids, and kissing them, and hugging them, and, I don't know, chasing them, they chasing him. I'm like, shouldn't he be my example?
Right.
If it's a matter of being firm and trying to lose my respect. But in fact, that's the opposite. See, what this does, if you come down to their level, if you play with them, if you love them, hug them, kiss them, what have you, actually that makes them respect you more. Because when they are respecting you for you being firm and strong, they're only being scared. They're not respecting you.
There's a difference between fearing and respecting.
Exactly. I'm scared. I can't say much. If I had the chance to say, like, I hate your guts.
Right.
A lot of kids, if they had the chance to speak and express themselves, they would actually tell their parents that they hate them.
And some do, actually.
And some do.
Right.
Why? Because the father or the mother or what have you, they think that if they enforce their strong personality in the house, they can maintain their respect. And I've seen this even with close relatives of mine.
Right.
They have this kind of mindset.
In their mind, respect is fear.
Yeah. Where, in fact, it should be the opposite. And the same people, and this is what the ironic, this is what we call hypocrisy, the nifaq of this, that when they go with their friends, they're laughing and joking and they curse each other, right, to that extent. And they, I don't know, they act like, you know, really pathetic, to say the least.
They humiliate themselves sometimes, right?
Yeah, but once they get to their house,
silence.
It's like they become Fir'aun.
Right.
So we're saying that this is an obstacle, an absolute obstacle for a parent if he wants to be loved and respected and are not giving the proper, adequate, you know, whatever it is that he's after.
Right.
It has to be done through love, affection, I don't know, through laughing, smiling, playing, coming down to their level. That's what gives you true, you know, true meaning of respect, true meaning of honor. They would honor you, glorify you based on the fact that you are giving them what they require, not that you are being firm and strong and stiff and what have you. That would not work.
And with that, dear Sayyid, let's go on ahead and take a quick break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing obstacles we face when raising our children and how we can solve them. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
All right, so we said one of the obstacles is that we give ourselves a fake sense of honor by trying to enforce strong personality.
Right.
Another obstacle that we need to remove in our way to become better educators and better parents is that we should not take it lightly when it comes to giving children whatever they want. Now, how does this work? Now, sometimes when kids want things, right, as a parent, because I love them and I want them to be happy, so whatever they want,
you give them.
I give them. I fulfill all the desires.
Right.
So this is what we call tasahul, just being lenient. Ah, it's okay, let them have
Too
it.
Lenient, I guess.
Ah, it's okay, let them have it. It was like, okay, it's late, let them go. Ah, it's okay, let them have another hour. They, you know, just they ate too much sweet. Ah, it's okay, this one should be fine. Nah, let them. So, like, you could see there's a sense of not caring.
A laid-back attitude.
A laid-back attitude and being flexible, too flexible in things that, you know, that are not required. And obviously, when the parent does this, he thinks he's showing love and affection and care for the children. Right. Where in fact, you're destroying the children. You're creating them to become, they themselves to become arrogant as they grow older, to become selfish, to become self-centered. Because all their life, all that's been happening is they've been receiving. They're not being giving.
Whatever they desire and wish for, they get.
Exactly. So they don't know what's happening here. They don't know what's, you know, what's needed of them. So it's always about me, me, me. So we say there are limitations. There are what we call hudud. Even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala beautifully, he says, تِلْكَ حُدُودُ اللَّهِ فَلَا تَتَعَدَّوهَا. There are limits. Okay? Maintain these limits.
Right.
We have no issue with you. Right?
Right.
You cross the limits, then we have problems.
The boundaries do not cross.
Yeah, so obviously, if you cross them, you are the one who's going to get affected. Not Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah does not get affected.
Right.
So one of these obstacles that parents face is that they cannot come to a way to control themselves when it comes to keeping the kids under control and safe and don't give them anything. Like sometimes I like to spoil my child, but sometimes I just don't care. Like whatever he wants, I give it to him. I want him to be happy.
Right.
And you see some people, some parents boasting about it. I gave my son everything. Whatever he wants, he has. And whatever he wants, I give to him. Well, that's not a good thing.
Right, you've ruined him.
Yeah, you're not doing him a good favor.
Right.
You know, you're not doing him a favor. You're actually destroying him.
Right.
You're destroying his personality. You're destroying what kind of person he's going to grow up.
You're making him entitled.
Yeah, exactly. So you're creating another Trump.
Right.
Trump says, well, I was poor. My father only gave me $1 million to play with.
A small loan of $1 million.
Yeah, a small loan of $1 million. A poor kid.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're going to have like mini Trumps.
Right,
so
of course.
Because you give them money or you give them what they want, it doesn't mean it's the right thing.
Right.
So this is one obstacle a lot of parents have to get over.
Right. Dear Sayyid, we will unfortunately have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank you for your time and for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If the dear listeners have any questions or other relevant comments and feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website, parstoday.com. Alternatively, you can also find us on the various social media accounts we have on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
In 2009, David Mendoza Herarte was extradited from Spain to the United States on condition he be allowed to serve his sentence in Spain. I have obtained classified documents which show the diplomatic assurances given by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid to Spain and how the United States violated the conditions of his extradition. Court documents sent to me show how the United States denied his transfer application numerous times. Mendoza spent over 6 years in the United States fighting to get back to Spain. While in prison, Mendoza sued both the United States and Spain for failing to uphold the conditions of his extradition and violating his human rights. His case is so extraordinary and such a miscarriage of justice that it was recently taken up by the United Nations. In October, Mendoza's case was mentioned in the English High Court, where the United States is now trying to extradite Julian Assange to the U.S. The United States has offered very similar diplomatic assurances, saying that Assange can serve his sentence in his home country, Australia. Assange's lawyers cited Mendoza's case as proof that these diplomatic assurances from the United States cannot be trusted. James Lewis, the lead U.S. prosecutor, told the High Court that, quote, the United States has never broken a diplomatic assurance. Will these documents, these classified diplomatic communications and court documents, paint a completely different picture? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. David Mendoza Herarte was born and raised in the United States, but he described Spain to me as his second home. He is both an American and Spanish citizen. Mendoza was wanted by the United States for drug trafficking in the early 2000s, moving marijuana between Canada across the border into Seattle. Mendoza first realized that U.S. authorities were onto him when he found a GPS tracker stuck on the bottom of his car. He told me that teams were put on him to survey him 24 hours a day, with federal agents even renting a house across the street from him. Mendoza dropped everything and decided to leave the United States for Mexico to stay at some property that he owned there. When he learned that there was a warrant out for his arrest, he moved to the Spanish capital, Madrid, in June 2006. 2 years later, in June 2008, the Spanish authorities arrested Mendoza under an international arrest warrant. The United States had requested his extradition on drug-related and money laundering charges. At this point, Mendoza had already settled in Spain and started a family. He was married and had one child with another on the way, both Spanish nationals. This is important because in Spain, if you go to jail, the government can't just put you in a facility that is so far away that it would prevent your family or make it practically impossible for them to see you. This is the right to private and family life under Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, in August 2008, the Spanish National Court ruled that Mendoza's extradition to the United States could only go ahead under three conditions. Number one, that he serve any sentence in Spain so he would be close to his family. Number two, no life sentence could be handed down. Number three, that he would not be tried for currency structuring. Spanish judges made two very clear rulings on this in August and November 2008. If the United States wanted to extradite David Mendoza, it had to send him back to Spain to serve his sentence. In January 2009, the United States Embassy in Madrid sent this. This is the classified diplomatic assurance given to Spain regarding Mendoza. The diplomatic assurance was worrying because it did not specifically state that Mendoza would be sent to Spain to serve his sentence. It only said that the United States, quote, does not object to Mendoza making an application to serve his sentence in Spain, something that the United States cannot do anyway because every prisoner has the right to apply for a treaty transfer anyway. A few months ago, in July 2021, the United States offered very similar diplomatic assurances to the United Kingdom so they could extradite Julian Assange. They said that Assange could serve a sentence in his home country, Australia. Now, here's the issue. It's not enough for the United States to say that it will let Assange go to Australia. Australia also has to consent to the transfer. Otherwise, it's meaningless. And I can tell you, as one of the only journalists covering Assange's extradition, Australia has said nothing about taking Assange. Now, in Mendoza's case, the United States diplomatic assurances to Spain were very ambiguous and vaguely worded. However, this next document, signed by the United States Embassy in Madrid, was certainly not. This document is called the Acta de Entrega, or Deed of Surrender. And what it says is very clear. The Acta de Entrega states that Mendoza was surrendered to U.S. authorities, and more importantly, it confirms that he was handed over, quote, in accordance with what was previously stipulated by Section 2 of the National Criminal Court. This means whoever signs this document agrees to the terms and conditions given by the Spanish court. They agree that Mendoza must serve his sentence in Spain. And who signed this document? The United States Embassy, David Mendoza, and Spain. On April 30th, 2009, David Mendoza Herarte was extradited to the United States right after signing this Acta de Entrega. Prosecutors threatened Mendoza with over 20 years in prison if he didn't hand over more of his property. The U.S. government had already taken $14 million worth of assets and properties from Mendoza, with most of them having nothing to do with narcotics or anything illicit. Mendoza was later sentenced and given 14 years in prison. He asked the court to respect the conditions of his extradition and send him back to Spain so he could carry out his sentence, as agreed. But it now became clear that the United States had no intention of sending Mendoza back to Spain. They had squeezed him for every last penny. and then violated the diplomatic assurances given to Spain. I spoke with Damon Mendoza. I asked him about his sentencing and how he found out that the United States never planned on actually sending him to Spain.
When I started getting a smell, a whiff, that they weren't going to comply with any of this, was when he asked me, because I said, Your Honor, there's some conditions that I want the court to recognize in respect of why Spain sent me, extradited me to the United States, that are required of the extradition. And he looked at me, and he put his glasses down, and he said, young man, he said, and I said, one of those conditions were I am to serve my sentence in Spain, as promised. And he said, young man, he said, are you familiar with the international instrument that has brought you to the United States? I said, yes. Do you know the name of that instrument? I said, yeah, it's the Spanish-U.S. extradition treaty. And he said, correct. He said, can I ask you another question? I said, obviously, you're the judge. He says, are you signatory on that? And I said, signatory? I said, obviously not. It's done by my government. Yours is done by your government, but it applies to all of us. He said, it does apply, but if you're not signatory, you don't have a right to claim. Meaning my government would have to make a claim against non-compliance of the treaty or the conditions that were applied within that treaty, not me. So right then I knew this is not looking good.
What the United States was essentially saying here is that Mendoza, his signature is not on the extradition treaty, so he can't make any claims, which is ridiculous because the extradition treaties in general are signed between countries, between governments, not people. Nevertheless, this is the argument that they made. Mendoza is certain that the United States government will play this exact same trick on Julian Assange. Assange will get to the United States. They might block his transfer to Australia or place him in oppressive prison conditions. And if he tries to contest this, they will say, hey, you didn't sign the extradition treaty. You have no claim. In Mendoza's case, however, there was a document that he, the United States, and Spain all signed together, which explicitly stated that he must serve his sentence in Spain, and it is the acta de entrega. All three signatures are right here. Now, Mendoza was given 14 years in prison. Instead of immediately sending him to Spain to carry out the sentence, he was told that he has to apply for a treaty transfer. He did. And the answer that he got from the United States was no.
I applied for a treaty transfer. They just told me, the embassy, I spoke to the Spanish embassy. It said, go ahead and just apply. You'll be back in a couple months to serve your sentence. I was sentenced to 14 years in federal prison for possession and distribution of marijuana. So I said, okay, let me apply to go back to Spain. So I applied, I think it was November 2009. It was towards the tail end of 2009 because they wouldn't allow me to apply there at the detention center. They said, oh no, we have to process you into prison. And I could see this was just a game play. So I said, screw it. I called up the embassy. I told them, listen, these guys are playing games. I need to apply and you need to help me make that application. They refused. They said, no, you have to do it through your case manager. So when I got to Colorado, they sent me to a medium-high institution in Colorado. When I got to Colorado, I asked the case manager there, who was assigned to me. I said, sir, there's some conditions. And he said, you can apply, but there's the United States is going to be told by anybody what to do. I said, all right. I mean, that's your position. There's to each their own. So I applied in 2009. And I was denied 6 months later in 2010. I think the summer, June or July of 2010. So then I started saying, wait a minute here. You know, you guys took an extra piece of property from me. I've got a contract. You promised Spain. It's black and white. And that's what I knew. We're going to have some serious problems here.
In total, Mendoza applied three times to transfer to Spain. All three applications were denied, violating the extradition conditions. Once he applied, he had to wait 8 months for a decision and even longer to apply again. This is the document from the U.S. Department of Justice denying his transfer in 2010. It states, there is no administrative appeal from this decision. Unless otherwise noted above, the prisoner may reapply 2 years after this denial. When the United States denied Mendoza's transfer in 2010, he immediately sued Spain. He figured the United States is not going to give him any justice. So he needs to get justice in Spain. He wanted to pressure Spain to pressure the U.S. to enforce the extradition conditions. Mendoza sued Spain in the criminal court, the constitutional courts, but got nowhere. His last option was the civil court. So in 2014, Mendoza filed two lawsuits against Spain. Number one, that the conditions of his extradition had been violated, and number two, that his human rights had been violated. Each case went to the Spanish Supreme Court. Mendoza won both.
So when the Supreme Court ruling came out a couple weeks later, it said, I don't care what you do, you need, first of all, it said that they were in total disbelief. It shows you the control and intimidation the United States has on these people. They were in total disbelief that the Spanish authorities only sent out two diplomatic notes saying, oh, over now at this point, a 6-year period of time, oh, could you please send Dave Mendoza back? It's required.
Two notes.
Two diplomatic notes. They were in total disbelief. The Spanish Supreme Court said, that's unacceptable. And they basically told him, if you can't resolve this, we will resolve it. And then a few weeks later came out my human rights violations. My human rights were being violated. So the Supreme Court made it very clear to him in that order that said, if this lasts any longer, we will take the actions necessary. And I asked my attorney, what actions are those? And she told me, Dave, those actions are, they're the only ones who can suspend a treaty. The court can actually suspend the extradition treaty between Spain and the United States. And she says, they don't want that to happen. This is your ticket home. They don't want that to happen because once they suspend the treaty, they can't cancel it, but they can suspend it because they say, well, it's not protecting the law and constitution of Spain. But when they suspend it, to reactivate that treaty, it has to go through the whole Congress and Parliament thing. And then it becomes highlighted, and then people start seeing it, and then the EU, other member states start seeing it. And these guys like to do things under the radar. And so that's when they said, we'll get them back.
At the same time Mendoza was suing Spain, there was also pressure coming from inside the country. Spanish judges didn't block, but stopped processing extraditions to the United States. They were basically telling the Americans, you better send Mendoza back if you want extraditions to the U.S. to continue.
So finally I wrote the Chief Justice. I wrote all the justices of the federal court, but I got a break when I wrote the Chief Justice. He wrote me back. He sent me a stack of documents. And he called in the U.S. Embassy personnel, I suspect Kimberly Weiss and company, and said, you're going to make this guy come back, because if not, we're going to cut your extraditions. As of this point, extraditions have been very fluid and very fructiferous, as he puts it, for the American authorities. They promised him, don't worry, Mendoza will be back by the summer. That ruling was September 2011. They said I'd be back in Spain by 2012. They promised him that. Well, didn't work. And so what they did, the Spanish judges, they have no authority to cancel or suspend any extradition treaty. But they were able to not process them. Like, you have a stack of extradition requests. We're going to put the Americans have on the bottom. That was pissing off the United States. So there was a lot of diplomatic communications going back. How can we get this resolved? Blah, blah, blah.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So at this point, Mendoza was suing Spain at the Supreme Court, and he was also suing the United States in civil court. He was suing Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder. And the United States came and told Mendoza, if he drops the lawsuit in the U.S., they'll let him go home. In the end, Mendoza reluctantly accepted, but he told me that dropping this suit was the biggest regret of his life.
In 2000 to 2012 or 13, whenever they changed the law, was a 6-year maximum sentence. Now remember, the acts of my crime were in 2006 and before, supposedly. I was sentenced in 2009. I requested to go back to Spain in 2009, which was denied. If they would have sent me back to Spain, I would have been back in Spain, which the Supreme Court said, yes, he should have been back in Spain in 2009 when he requested. That's what the condition was. There was no new law then in Spain. When I get back to Spain, this judge, who's now the Minister of Interior, I don't know what the hell, he's one of these neoliberals here in Spain. This judge basically says no. Well, first he told my attorney, yes, don't worry, Dave's going to get out. 3 days later, my attorney comes visit me in prison in Spain and says, I got bad news for you. I had a second discussion, communication with him, and he says, he's not letting you out. Somebody touched him. I said, what do you mean somebody touched him? He said, somebody told him that ain't happening. I have no doubt it was Miss Kimberly Weiss, you know, and I suspect what she did was, the Americans are pissed. I want you to know that we don't want Mendoza out.
When Spain conditioned Mendoza's extradition, when it said that he must serve his sentence in Spain, it imposed this condition in order to protect the nucleus of the family. That's the whole point. And in the end, the United States succeeded in violating the whole essence of this requirement. Mendoza's family and relationships suffered tremendously from his extradition and the fact that the United States kept him there for almost 7 years, violating the requirements of the Spanish court.
2 years in my sentence, my wife divorced me. Understood why. You know, I said, it's got a 14-year sentence. Doesn't look good here. So she divorced me. You know, I didn't hold that against her. I understood it. Everything that the court, Spanish court, attempted to establish on that condition, the United States successfully destroyed. And why, I'm not quite sure even yet, but they did. You know, you and I have had discussions as to maybe why, but then we'll get into that. But they destroyed. My two little boys, who are now 12 and 13, don't call me Dad. They call me David. My mother and father passed away while I was in prison. It is what it is, you know, and I know there's people out there, well, you got yourself in that position, you got to swallow it. Yeah, but that doesn't allow you to break the law. That doesn't allow you to break the law.
In 2013, a French court blocked the extradition of Michael and Linda Mastro to the U.S., citing Mendoza's case as proof that France could not trust assurances from the United States. Mendoza has helped many others fighting extraditions in the U.S., and he hopes that his case will also help Julian Assange. Assange faces up to 175 years in a U.S. prison for publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States has offered assurances that it won't place Assange in special administrative measures, or SAMs, which are known as the worst prison conditions, complete isolation. The U.S. also said that Assange could serve a potential sentence in Australia, in his home country.
They said they would consent to Julian Assange's transfer to Australia. But let me show you something here. And I'm as familiar with this as most anybody. This is a treaty, the Convention of Strasbourg, to allow prisoners to transfer from one country to another. Okay? This is the international instrument that allows that to take place. They made very clear that, oh yeah, they have no problems. They will allow him to be transferred to Australia. I can tell you what they're going to do. The treaty obligates all parties must agree to the transfer. That means, okay, the United States has given their consent. Obviously, Julian Assange will say yes. But we have no assurances that the Aussies will say yes. They're one of the Five Eyes. I can tell you they're going to probably say, uh-uh. Just like that has happened on not one, I'm telling you, all the inmates in federal prison, well, not all of them, but the ones in Fort Dix would come to me that had extradition issues because they saw me as the go-to guy. And they would say, how can we force this? And you know what the United States would say? It's not us. We've given the consent. What they would do is the United States has these backdoor communications with the Canadian government. At that time, Harper was involved. who's a conservative, don't ask for the transfer. Sorry, not asking for your transfer. It's not us. We've complied with the document. So for that to have any weight, the most minimal weight, and they're going to try and screw them anyway, the Aussies need to say, we agree to that too. They need to send a diplomatic note.
When it comes to Julian Assange, Mendoza made something very clear. Diplomatic assurances like this need to be signed by all three parties. That means the US, the UK, and Julian Assange, okay? Because if either party refuses to comply, Assange can go and contest that in a United States court, despite him not being a signatory of the extradition treaty. Because the first thing the US will say is, well, you did not sign the extradition treaty between the US and the UK. You don't have any claim. But if there is a contract with all three signatures, Assange does have a claim. Now, regarding Assange carrying out a sentence in Australia, the United States needs to explicitly say in the diplomatic note that it consents to his transfer. But that's not everything, as Mendoza explains.
And then within that diplomatic note, it should say Julian Assange has a right to contest any of these conditions if they are not applied correctly, or if one of the parties find non-application. Okay, they're not just Julian Assange, the U.S. government, or give the right to all of them. But they all three need to have that right to contest those documents. I'm a nobody. And they went to the extent of this to do it to a nobody. Can you imagine what they're going to do to, I mean, if all these promises that they're making for Julian, or making to the court on behalf of Julian, do you think, I mean, I'm a nobody. And not just that. If he doesn't have a signed contract that he's signatory of, and that specifically stipulates that he can sue the Americans as equally as the Brits for not compliance with this.
The lead prosecutor in Assange's case said that the United States has never, ever broken a diplomatic assurance. Well, that's simply not true. These documents show very clearly the United States broke its diplomatic assurances to Spain. The agreement to send Mendoza to Spain to serve his sentence was violated. This is undeniable. Only after suing both the United States and Spain, his own countries, was Mendoza allowed to return. Only after Spain's Supreme Court threatened to suspend the extradition treaty did the Americans finally allow Mendoza to go back. Mendoza had the Spanish Supreme Court, senior Spanish judges, and the Spanish public on his side. Assange does not. Assange is neither American nor British. In the event the U.S. violates its diplomatic assurances, which is practically guaranteed, Assange has no one to fight on his behalf, not even the Australian government. And given the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain, the idea that Britain would force the U.S. to abide by the extradition conditions is simply unrealistic. If the United States gives assurances to the United Kingdom in order to extradite Julian Assange, these assurances must be worded very explicitly and signed by all parties, including Assange, so that he may contest any non-compliance in court on his own behalf. When it comes to diplomatic assurances from the United States, it's not a question of, are these assurances enough? It's a question of, can these assurances be enforced once Julian Assange is in the United States? This is what the judges in the English High Court must ask themselves. While they still have the power to stop the United States from criminalizing journalism and violating Assange's human rights. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, today, brothers and sisters, we are going to speak about patience. When it comes to what patience is, of course, patience is the capacity to tolerate pain difficulties and hardships in our life. So it's a great gift from Allah. There are fewer people around us who exercise patience and who can be categorized as sabirun, or the ones who observe patience in the face of difficulties, hardships, and vicissitude. Obviously, in Islam, the quality of being patient comes with many benefits and rewards. Patience is an admirable quality which helps us connect with Allah. It is to endure with strength any hardship. Of course, Allah Almighty has promised those who endure hardship and those who are patient tremendous reward and tremendous sawab. Patience is to hold one's soul from being impatient and displeased, holding the tongue from complaining and the body parts from harming himself or others. Because we see in our day-to-day life there are people who are not patient, so they either start inflicting harm upon themselves or they cause harm upon other people. So it's sometimes forbidden in Islam, you know. For example, if someone's dear and near dies, it's not permissible for him or her to start scratching his or her face, you know, plucking his or her hair. And of course, if a person does this, he has sinned, he has committed a haram act, because it is always necessary to be patient in the face of any disaster, any mishap, any tragedy that takes place in our life. So that's why Allah Almighty has promised that He is with the sabirun. He is with those who observe patience. And there are many verses in the Quran which shows the virtues and greatness of patience. Now, in the Arabic language, the word sabr is a common word. It is a word which has also been repeatedly mentioned in different verses of the Quran. And it literally means patience. Patience and the word sabr actually, according to Arabic dictionary, means to contain. What to contain? Of course, we have to contain our anger, we have to contain our, emotions and our, sentiments, whatever that takes us out of control. So, as I defined the word patience in the beginning, technically the word patience is the capacity to accept or tolerate problems, to accept and endure suffering without becoming annoyed or anxious. And that's what patience is about. That's what sabr is actually about. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome to your program for a better life. We are discussing patience. Respected brothers and sisters, patience has great status in the sight of Allah. It is highly encouraged in different, religious sources. the Quran being one of them. And of course, the prophetic tradition is another important source in which you can find the tremendous reward of patience. And patience is considered to be the best of deeds and the best of actions. Allah Almighty has said in the noble Quran, قُلْ يَا عِبَادِيَ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اتَّقُوا رَبَّكُمْ لِلَّذِينَ أَحْسَنُوا فِي هَذِهِ الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةٌ وَأَرْضُ اللَّهِ وَاسِعَةٌ إِنَّمَا يُوَفَّى الصَّابِرُونَ أَجْرَهُمْ بِغَيْرِ حِسَابٍ. Say, O my servants who have believed, fear your Lord, for those who do good in this world is good, and the earth of Allah is spacious, it is vast. Indeed, the patient will be given their rewards without account. So, the verse explicitly and clearly states that those who are patient, they will receive their full rewards without any hisab, without any limit, without any calculation, and without any estimation. You know, this is what sabr is, and this is how much Islam values sabr, patience. Of course, you can go to the Holy Quran, see chapter 39, verse 10, and you'll find the verse in there. And if you would like, you can also read the commentary of this verse. And this is not the only verse that you can read in the Quran. There are more than 100 verses. And the Quran, according to Mufassirin, according to the exegetes of the Quran, there are more than 100 verses which clearly relate to the concept of patience. So we can conclude, not only from this verse, but also from other verses in the Quran, that there is reward only for those among us who are patient. And of course, in this world, we face many challenges, many difficulties, or trials and tribulations, and the sufferings are there.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
What we have to do is to exercise patience. We have to be patient because Allah Almighty loves those who exercise patience in any time and any occasion, because it's not confined to a specific condition. Patience is always recommended. It's always important. Allah is with the sabirin. Allah is with the patient. In Allah ma'as sabirin. There is no doubt as to the fact that calamities do happen in everybody's life. You cannot find anyone on this earth, on this planet, who may have lived without hardship, without difficulty. At one stage of his life or another, he might have suffered pain, misery, adversities, difficulties, vicissitude, trial, and tribulation. And obviously, these trials and tribulations are for good, you know. There is a philosophy behind them. Without hardship, without pain, we do not value prosperity, happiness, and ease. It's through those difficulties that we understand the value of hardship. And it's through those challenges that we actually understand the value of ease and comfort and tranquility. Inshallah, you will be patient in your life. Hardships are there, but in Allah ma'as sabirin, Allah is with those who are patient. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Human rights groups have criticized French President Emmanuel Macron's meeting with Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, a meeting which took place on Saturday, 4th of December. The meeting marked the first one-on-one public meeting of a major Western leader with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia since the state-sponsored assassination of the dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Angelique Chrysafis and Stephanie Kirschgassner. The piece is titled, Emmanuel Macron Accused of Trying to Rehabilitate Mohammed bin Salman. Human rights groups have criticized French President Emmanuel Macron's meeting with Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. The meeting took place on Saturday, 4th of December. The meeting marked the first one-on-one public meeting of a major Western leader with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia since the state-sponsored assassination of the dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. For 3 years since the 2018 murder of Khashoggi, Western heads of state have avoided direct one-on-one meetings with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. The US President Joe Biden has even avoided speaking to the future King of Saudi Arabia in what has widely been seen as an attempt to avoid conferring legitimacy on the de facto ruler. But President Macron's move suggests at least one major Western leader is ready to formally re-establish ties to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia directly, less than a year after U.S. intelligence agencies released a report stating they believed that Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Whatever strategic interest France has in Saudi Arabia, nothing can justify their legitimization of a ruler who kills journalists, threatens activists, imprisons Saudi women and human rights defenders, slaughters Yemeni civilians, and deceives the international community. Emmanuel Macron diminishes himself and his own country as he stoops to partnership with Mohammed bin Salman,